Hello and welcome to Talk Fertility, a show where we do just that, talk about fertility. I'm Natalie Silverman, host of the Fertility Podcast, which I launched in 2015, once successfully pregnant after having fertility treatment.
And I'm Kate Davis, a trained fertility nurse and founder of Your Fertility Journey, where I work one-to-one with women and couples to help them understand and optimise their fertility.
Now, before we start this show, I just wanted to let you know that this is a conversation I had without Kate. We aren't able to record our shows together. We record them remotely. And sometimes there's content that I've already created that I want to share with you. And so what I'm doing is getting Kate to give her thoughts on it. And normal service will resume in next week's show. So have a listen, then you'll hear what Kate's got to say about it at the end. So welcome to another episode of Meet the Makers, which is my new series, finding the people that are making cool stuff as a result of what's a shitty situation. And I'm finding you in all different places. And obviously Instagram is such a massive community for the TTC space. There's bound to be lots of exciting stuff happening. And I'm going to introduce a husband and wife who have been making socks. Katie and Tom Jenkins, welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
Hello, thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Well, we had a few technical issues. I thought I was going to have to say we're going to have to leave it, but we've done it. So I'm really excited. Now, I spotted your socks on Instagram, and socks are obviously a thing. And I know that the main reason for the socks was to add a bit of fun into what's gone on. But before we talk about that, can we just talk a little bit about what's gone on? Your experience of anything to do with stuff going wrong happened at possibly the worst point. Not that there's ever a good point for anything to go wrong when you're trying to have a family, but you basically suffered a loss just before you were due to get married, didn't you?
Yeah, it was about 3 weeks before. And we went to our 12-week scan and we actually found out at the scan. And there was no heartbeat. And it was devastating. Absolutely devastating.
So we went in thinking that we was going to see the first scan, and that was the day that they told us. So that was quite a rough one.
Yeah, and we got married 3 weeks after that.
Yeah.
What a kind of bittersweet day that must have been.
Oh, it was. I thought at one point, oh, do we postpone it? But then I thought, no, we want to do this. So, yeah, we carried on. And everyone said it was like the best wedding that they went to, because it was like a small wedding, but...
Yeah, it wasn't the same. We were supposed to have a big wedding. That was the plan. But because
we brought it forward,
Katie fell pregnant, we decided let's get the wedding out of the way while she's pregnant, and then we'll deal with the, you know, hopefully have the baby later, so we didn't have to worry about a wedding. So that's why we went for a smaller wedding, didn't we?
Yeah.
And then that was already booked and everyone was due to arrive, and then we found that out, and then it was just sort of a very surreal type thing, wasn't it? And then we ended up having a smaller wedding and we didn't have the baby, so it was... Yeah, it was very
bittersweet.
Yeah,
and quite a lot to just get your head around. All these things that you're trying to process at what should be a happy time. Were you able then to manage a bit of grieving? Because the kind of the assumption is that you just got married, yay! Yet you've just come through something really difficult. And you want to be sad, but you want to be happy as well.
Yeah, I think Tom grieved quite quickly. It took me a few months actually, because obviously with the wedding and everything, I still had that planning to do, so it took me a few months. And then
it was quite strange because I never get emotional really, and then I was quite emotional straight away after, because everyone in our family, as soon as they've been pregnant, apart not Katie's had my side, they just have a baby. So I always thought, you know, you get pregnant, you have a baby, and that's that. So we've never gone through any, you know, no one's ever lost it before, so I was quite emotional from that, which sort of helped me straight away. Whereas Katie sort of held on to it, didn't you, for a while? And I think that's, she had a few rough times after that, until she got hold of, you know, this community, which sort of got everything back to where it was, didn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Which was good, yeah.
Because Katie, am I right in saying that you found people online after a second miscarriage? That was when you started to look and find, to see if there were people that you could just get some support and some inspiration from.
Definitely. So it was literally exactly a year later, we fell pregnant again, but we knew quite early on that that wasn't going to work out. It was what's called a blighted ovum. So my body thought it was still pregnant and it was growing the sac, the gestational sac, but then they have to call it at a certain time. And I think that was about 10 weeks. And when they said, no, this isn't viable. So I went through all of that again. With, you know, you look things online and think you hear success stories and they found it and stuff, but no, they didn't. And then that's when I turned to Instagram, and there's quite a few Facebook groups as well. And the support on there is just brilliant. I was about 26 then, and a lot of my friends, you know, they've either got kids or they're still out partying and everything at weekends. And we just felt in limbo, didn't we? And we didn't really, no one understood us.
No.
So it was so nice to go on to that sort of platform and find other couples going through the same thing.
And did you find it useful, Tom, or did Katie look and tell you stuff? Were you interested in reading stuff?
No, I was, because due to work and everything, so I was always away, and Katie was always on these forums. The thing I liked about it is that she was getting back to herself, so I didn't mind. She was on them like all the time, and it was good because it was keeping her, you know, mentally sort of with it, as opposed to before where she was always down and almost like depressed quite a lot of the time. So I didn't mind it in that sense, but I didn't realize what they were all talking about on there and how sort of how much it does help everyone, until after like a while of Katie constantly talking about it, I decided to have, you know, get involved myself and have a look.
And you understand it now, don't you?
I sort of got involved. Now I'm sort of almost obsessed with everything.
When you say, Tom, you got involved, did you find other men that you could talk to online?
No, I haven't found other men that I could speak to, but it was strange because I speak to everyone about it normally at work and my friends. I've not spoke to anyone that's going through it, but I opened up way more even at work. So if Katie was having issues, I'd say, you know, we're having trouble, she's on this site and everything, it really helps. And I know a few people that are doing IVF at work, and I'd tell them, you know, where to go, and tell your wife to have a look at this and have a look at it yourself. And that's what sort of opened me up. Whereas before, I sort of viewed IVF a bit differently before, because I didn't understand it.
Mm.
And then once I understood it, I spoke to like all the people I work with now. They all know about the miscarriages we've had, about the IVF that didn't work out, and now we're on FET. I've even got lads at work that don't have a clue about any of it, going, oh, how's your FET? So, you know.
I love that you're all using the acronym. It's very impressive.
Yeah, exactly. That's Katie, that is. She uses them all the time, and now, like, I use them. And I know them all as well, like, TWW and all that.
Yeah. But that's what we want. We want to normalise this conversation. And Katie, just what Tom was saying about how before you'd found the kind of forums and the different social platforms, you were pretty down. Did you get any support or any counselling elsewhere?
I remember being referred from work, because I work at the hospital anyway. It was almost kind of because I worked there, and like, I don't know everybody in the hospital, but I was a bit afraid of like, oh, what if word like gets around or something that she is feeling down. So I never took that as a route, but watching everybody's stories now and on Instagram and the help that they got, I kind of wish, oh, I should have got help, because it kind of took, like, it's basically took 3 years of my life, I felt, with everything going on. So I do wish, and I would say to everybody, if you feel down, definitely go and get help or talk to somebody about it.
And are you talking more openly? It sounds like Tom's like the IVF advocate in the workplace.
I've always been really open to like friends and family. Like they know everything, you know, they follow all of my, like my Instagram account and everything. Yeah, I have been quite open, but it's nice, like I said, to find people that are going through it as well. But all my friends have been supportive and family, so that's good as well.
Well, we're talking at a point where you've said you've had a scan, you're kind of getting ready for your frozen embryo transfer. I'll use the whole phrase for those that don't know what an FET is. By the time we share this, we might be further along in the 2 week wait. We might have a success. Who knows? We'll keep in touch. So let's bring in the socks, because the socks are there to ultimately document the journey. Tell me how you came up with them. Tell me what people can get, and tell me what you want to achieve with your socks.
Yeah, so how we came up with this socks, it was quite interesting actually. At our first cycle, so the fresh cycle, the first one we ever did, at all the appointments we went to, Katie was always in like her standard socks that she was wearing.
What is your standard sock, Katie? Just a black or a white?
I bought like pineapple socks.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so not your standard socks at all. You already had quirky socks.
Not your standard socks. Good socks.
Good socks, all right.
She would always say, oh, no, I wish I could put something on these to you know, on social media, like what stage we were at. So say we was going in for a, like transfer day or something like that. There was nothing that actually said it on it. She'd always write it on the screen. And we didn't think anything of it. And then...
It was after it failed, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it was after
like,
it failed.
We were even sat on the landing and I was like, I want to do something.
Yeah.
Like, we even thought, stupidly, of like, well, not headbands, but something. But then, yeah. And then I was like, no, that would be a bit silly. So I was like, socks.
A bit
like
more subtle.
Yeah. So we wanted to do socks, but we looked... When we looked around at them, we seen that there's a lot of socks where the, you know, the writing and maybe pictures are on the top of the foot. And but we wanted to do something that brought, because obviously it's normally couples that are going through IVF, whether that's, you know, man and man or whatever it is, that's got a surrogacy and everything like that. So there's always more than one person involved. So we wanted to have two people. So obviously the woman who's going through the IVF, and the person who's with them, he can then take the photos and sort of feel, so it made me feel a bit more involved.
All right. So
as Katie's there and she's going through everything and, you know, doing what she's got to do, I can take the photos and get involved with her as well. And I just feel like it's a bit more fun and it definitely takes, it's a talking point for social
when
media.
You post them up.
And it was more exciting. It's definitely more exciting, we feel, for us, yeah. So we enjoy doing that. And that's why we decided to do it.
So tell me about what you've got on the socks so far, because I've seen MB Baby on board, Sticky Vibes, TWW obviously for 2 week wait.
Like the journey starts here, which is when you start your first cycle or when it, what, whichever cycle you go to. So that's the first sock that you can use.
Or the start of any journey, like any journey.
Any journey really, yeah. And then we've got a 2 week wait sock. So once you've had your transfer, that's the 2 week wait sock we've got there. That's got a little clock on it, so obviously for the wait. We've got transfer day sock, which is what we'll be using soon. Just got a little heart on it with transfer day written on the bottom. We've got M Baby on board. So once you've had your transfer, you're then waiting. Obviously, hopefully, you're carrying the M Baby and hopefully you'll get a good pregnancy test at the end of that. And then we've got Sticky Vibes, which is Katie's favourite because it's got a pineapple on it. So that's got a pineapple on it, Sticky Vibes, hoping that it sticks to the lining and you get a positive pregnancy test. And then one of my favorite ones is the Be a Warrior, Not a Warrior socks. That could be for anyone really. Mm-hmm. So that's anyone going through any, whether that's mental health like issues or anything.
Maybe,
yeah that's for anyone going through that, and that's a really good sock as well.
But it's like when we're commenting on like everyone's post, everybody's like Sticky Vibes or good luck in the 2 week wait, and it was just I just found that everybody was saying those different phrases, and I was just like on Instagram, like you follow so many people, and I just thought with these socks you can like stand out, and then it would be like, oh stop, I want to hear their story and start talking, and if other people are going through the same thing or at the same time, then they'll know straight away from the picture.
So the idea is there's a united sock front going on.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Well, I think it's lovely. I mean, I've seen some quirky socks in different places from people sharing them, and I think that there's definitely a place for it, obviously, when you've got your feet up as well, to be showing off your socks. And what kind of feedback have you had so far?
A lot of people like say, oh, they really like the sock. We've only been going for a month.
Yeah.
So had a few sales. Quite a few people have promoted them on Facebook on their stories, and they say that they love the colours, that they're vibrant.
There's,
and
there's a lot of people that say,
and they're like 75% cotton as well. So
lovely.
They always say, oh, they're really good quality.
I like a sock as well that's got detail on the toe and the heel, which you've done.
Because we got
pineapples on there as well.
Once we decided to do them, we was drawing sketches for ages, didn't we, about how we wanted to do them. And then we eventually came up with what we've got now, but it took a while to get it. And then obviously with the comfort of it had to be a comfortable sock. That was one of our main points, wasn't it? To get it. So it's like comfortable, stylish, looked good, and also had, you know, you can document it. And quite a lot of the colours are quite bright and in your face colours.
Yeah.
So they stand out, especially on pictures. They stand out really well. So.
And it's also, if people didn't want to use them as, you know, for social media purposes, I can use them as like my lucky socks, I almost treat them as.
Yeah.
And just nice that I'm wearing them on that day. And if, you know, I've got diaries, I've got stuff from each cycle, and that's something that can go into that box in the hope that you do have a baby in the future. And you can show, oh, I wore these this day.
Yeah. Well, there's also, they're a nice gift idea, and that Instagram community is a really lovely, there's lovely posts I see of people sharing things that other people have sent to them. And I think that this is something that could really catch on with people wanting to show support to their kind of TTC pals that they've met. So I wish you the best of luck. I think it looks cool. I hope that they are your lucky socks. I hope you get your sticky vibes on when you go to your transfer, and do keep me posted.
Absolutely, yeah.
We will.
We're going to document all one anyway now, exactly, on every stage, so we better look at work this time.
Yeah, everything crossed. All right, cool. Well, best of luck with it. And if people want to get your socks, I'll put the details of how to follow you on Insta and everything in the show notes. But what's your website?
It's thejourneystartshere.co.uk. And we've got a special code for Fertility Poddy listeners. FP25 for 25% off.
Lovely.
But that's only on the individual socks, not on the collections
are discounted
20% off anyway.
Okay, so you can buy the whole collection or you can buy them individually depending on where you're at. Cool. Nice. Well, we will make it all very clear on the show notes for this as well, and look forward to seeing the collection grow, and who knows where the sock world will take you. It's very exciting.
Yeah,
exactly.
Thank you.
Very nice.
Lovely to chat.
And you.
You take care.
I have to admit, when Natalie first asked me to listen to a recording that she did about fertility socks, I think I gave her a bit of a sigh. And the reason I gave a bit of a sigh is that I kind of assumed wrongly that it was all surrounding this myth and perception that if you wear socks during embryo transfer, you've got an increased chance of success. And that's based on the myth that if you have warm feet at that time, then you'll also have a warm uterus. But unfortunately, there's no scientific evidence to support that myth. The body maintains a core body temperature so that your organs are kept at the same temperature constantly, and your external temperature, so therefore your feet, is very different to your core body temperature. So actually the wearing of socks, although making you feel very comfortable and lovely, doesn't actually affect the warmth of your internal organs and particularly your uterus. However, I really enjoyed listening to the lovely Katie and Tom. What a lovely couple. And I so loved hearing about how their idea of fertility socks came about as a result of their second miscarriage. And I think what I really, really love about the Meet the Maker series is that out of something so difficult and traumatic for women and couples comes out something so wonderful and help, and particularly in this case, something really, really helpful to others within the trying to conceive community. And I think that is so special. I absolutely love the way that they talked about that. What they found is that by women wearing socks, and they're posting this lovely image of their socks on social media, that automatically tells a story of where they are in their fertility journey, whether it be embryo transfer or the 2-week wait. And as a result of that, that's kind of all I guess they really need to say. They need to put this picture up. And as a result of that, they're getting tremendous support from the trying to conceive community. And it's amazing, isn't it, how support can come from and in so many different ways. And I think this is a really lovely novel way of reaching out for that support and receiving all that lovely support. I also found it so interesting when Tom was saying that a result of him taking a photo of Katie and her socks during their treatment, he felt so much more involved with the process. I just think that's just wonderful. And also, really importantly, put an element of fun. And I'm all about having fun and making sure that you live your life while you're going through a fertility journey. And this is just a fantastic example of that. I think it's fantastic as well that you can gift these socks.
So we know how difficult it is sometimes for people to, families and friends, to show support. Sometimes they don't always get it right in the words that they might say. But by letting somebody know that you're thinking of them, just with a little simple pair of socks, is such a wonderful idea. And I love the fact that, as Katie and Tom were saying, that for Katie, it was her lucky socks. Many women might choose to use them for that if they don't really want to post on social media. And also the fact that that's almost like keeping a journal. It's detailing your journey through the treatment, which actually might be a lovely thing to keep in a keepsake box and share perhaps with your child in the future. So a really, really lovely, positive story, and a fantastic business that Tom and Katie have developed, and I just love it. Just love it. I've already messaged them after I listened to the recording that Natalie had, and we've been chatting already, so she's really nice. It's nice to connect with them. And a massive thank you to Katie and Tom for their discount code for the podcast. That's just so generous, and I hope everyone takes advantage of it as much as you possibly can.
Now we're going to move from one Tom to another as I continue to share some content from the Fertility Podcast archives, which means that Kate isn't in these chats either, but as I've said, normal services will resume next week. I wanted to just explain something that's gone on in my world, as I work as a voiceover artist, and I've recently been asked to narrate a really brilliant new documentary that's nearly finished called The Easy Bit, which is all about male fertility. And you will have heard Kate and I in conversation with Gareth, with Rod Silvers in previous episodes, and the feedback that we've had from you about how helpful this content is, just a testament to the fact that we need to continue to help men share their voices. And it's something that Tom Webb, who's a director, has been doing. I spoke to Tom a good couple of years ago about his own infertility experience, and then also caught up with him on a panel discussion that I was chairing at Fertility Fest, which has been going now since 2016. It's an amazing arts festival combining the issues of infertility with artists and experts discussing it and performing it. Have a look at fertilityfest.com. So you're going to hear Tom telling me about his journey, and then you're going to hear an excerpt from the film that is going to be shown in London. It's premiering on the 28th of September at the Rain Dance Festival, which I believe is sold out, I'm afraid. But Kate and I will keep you up to date on our socials as far as how you can see it, because they will be sharing their plans of what's going to happen after the 28th of September. But for now, here's Tom.
It's been a long, long journey. We were trying to conceive for about 12 years. It took us a very long time to get NHS funding for our fertility treatment. We went through all sorts of hoops, tests, jumps. We had unexplained fertility.
So frustrating.
Yeah, every test we did came back, oh yeah, you're fine. We don't know why you're infertile. You can't make this happen naturally.
How did that make you feel though, with that such an inconclusive diagnosis being given at the time? Were the pair of you able to talk it through and get your heads around it?
It was very, very difficult, because it's really weird, because you end up going into appointments kind of thinking, I kind of hope there is something wrong, because then we'd know what it was. And then even when you come out of the appointment, you're kind of, oh, thank goodness, everything's okay, but we're back at square one, because we don't know what the problem is. We had various things that kind of stopped us from getting the NHS funding. My wife had to lose a lot of weight with her BMI. It was too high, and she eventually resorted to having a gastric bypass operation. Throughout this entire process, she has really put herself through it, and what she's been through has been incredible, really. All the procedures she's gone through and surgeries and all sorts of stuff. When it's unexplained, both of you kind of take on that, or maybe it is me. Maybe there's something they've missed. Maybe the analysis they've just done was a one-off and happened to be a good day. You kind of get all of those doubts kind of creep in, and that can be really difficult. Each of you kind of struggle in your own way, I think. We're quite open about stuff, and we always have been. So there have only been a few occasions where we haven't spoken about stuff, and it's usually me that kind of bottles things up a little bit or goes a bit introspective. And that would happen sort of during the fertility treatment, mostly during like our 2-week wait and stuff like that. And it would all kind of come to a point where we just blow up a bit and we would sort of hash it out and we'd always feel better afterwards. And it was one of those things that you kind of realise that sometimes you don't really want to have that conversation because you don't want to upset your partner, but sometimes you just kind of have to, because otherwise it just builds up into something that could be detrimental or more detrimental. Family knew, and things like work colleagues knew. I work in a really quite kind of small, close-knit company, and everyone's incredibly supportive of each other, and we're all really kind of friends, really. So if people are going through a tough time, they're quite happy to say why, and if they don't want to talk about it, everyone kind of understands and is kind of supportive and just kind of lets them get on with it. Nick works in a much larger company, which was less considerate because they're more HR focused and have more processes involved and all that kind of stuff. But her direct boss I think he was in the loop and kind of understood a little bit what we were going through, or at least tried to. Obviously, you know, we told our family, and even then people think or try to be supportive, think they're being supportive, but I think it's very difficult for people who haven't been through infertility to kind of understand what the best support is.
Definitely. They don't know quite when to ask and what to ask if they know that you're going through it. People just don't know whether to ask the question or just stay away, and then it becomes awkward, doesn't it?
Yeah, very much so. That's why when Nick and I started our treatment, we decided to write a blog. And the reason we did it wasn't necessarily kind of share our story to the wider world. It was pretty much just a way that we could keep our family and friends informed of what was going on, but without having to repeat everything 20 different times to different people and have the same conversations over and over again. That kind of ended up getting a wider audience, and it was actually strangers and other people that were going through fertility that ended up talking to us and giving us support. And, you know, obviously our families were there to do anything we needed them to. Yeah, I think it's still very difficult to kind of comprehend. And, you know, I know my parents would read the blog and talk to us about specific things, but generally we would have already spoken to them first before anything was posted. I think it was a really worthwhile thing to do. And the feedback we got from, you know, just people all over the world who were reading it, finding it helpful, was enough to make us kind of continue doing it. Even when you have to write the hardest of truths, it kind of spurs you on to know that somebody out there somewhere is getting some sort of solace out of it. There were some very tough things to kind of talk about. We had two rounds of IVF that we were entitled to. Both of them failed. And we'd kind of gone in knowing that we were going to get two rounds. So I think we kind of decided that we would have a plan B, so that if anything didn't work, we would have an idea of what we would want to do with our lives if we were going to be childless. And that was a pretty tough thing to work out and do. And after the second round failed, we had to kind of face up to the fact that we had to kind of go ahead with our plan B, really. And that was probably one of the toughest things to write about, and the fact that it had all failed and we were going to be childless, or thought we were. And then our story kind of took a really bizarre turn about 6 months later. So I don't know if you're up to date with what's happened with us.
No, because the last I thought of your story was that you were going to go off travelling.
Right, okay.
And then I started seeing you with your production work. So bring me up to speed.
Yeah, okay. So we spent 6 months in a pretty dark place, certainly for me personally. We were finding it very, very tough. It kind of got to the point where every month was a sort of a reminder that we were never going to have kids for Nick. And she decided to look into having a hysterectomy, which was, again, another challenging decision to make, because that would mean it was completely over and we would have absolutely no chance of having a child ourselves. So we went to see a consultant and we explained everything we'd done. And Nick basically said the only procedure that no one had ever done on her was a laparoscopy to look for endometriosis. Even though it was pretty clear that she didn't have endometriosis, they'd never done that specific procedure. The consultant then said, okay, well, we'll do an exploratory laparoscopy to look for endometriosis. And while I'm there, I'll do a cuticle on the womb lining and I'll give you some blood thinners to take for 3 months afterwards, and you should try naturally and you'll get pregnant. And we kind of sat there and it was like this massive slap in the face, because we'd got ourselves into this point where we were prepared for what our lives were going to be. We were really grieving and trying to come to terms with the fact that we were going to be childless. And there was this woman just basically saying, oh yeah, don't worry, I can sort it out with this little procedure that I can just do whilst I'm doing something else, and just try naturally and you'll be fine. When I tell this story, the most common question I get is like, why didn't they do this sooner? And it's kind of weird, because when we did our second round of IVF, we asked about things like endometrial scratches and all that kind of stuff. And they said, no, there's no point. There's no evidence that they work. There's no evidence components, so they don't work either. Yeah, so it, you know, it's kind of like there were things that we were kind of offered but not, and we came out of that consultation and we were just like, we were kind of begrudgingly like, okay, well, we have to give it a go. I mean, you can't, you know, we've been offered this opportunity and you can't turn that down, but it's never going to work. But we would regret it for the rest of our lives if we didn't at least give it a try. So she had the procedure and first month we got pregnant.
How amazing was Tom's news just there? I cut out my shriek in the original interview. You're now going to hear Tom introducing an excerpt from the EasyBit documentary. It was recorded from Fertility Fest. The quality isn't great, so apologies for that. But you can obviously hear it, otherwise I wouldn't be sharing it. I just wanted to explain why it sounds like there's somebody in the room with a microphone, because I wasn't far off to how we captured it.
So I'm making a documentary called The Easy Bit, which is about what it's like for men to go through fertility treatment. It's six men talking to camera about their experiences, and we've cut together a special short reel to show you today. The reel you're going to see is what it's like for men to go into what I refer to as the chamber of euphemism. It's basically what it's like for them to go and give their sperm sample on egg collection day.
On egg collection day, I'm going to do my part, and I don't remember if Davina was somewhere, or I was somewhere, or like where I went, or how I got to where I was going. But I remember I open the door, there's a corridor, then there's like a definite feel, atmosphere change. You go from where all the women seem to be to this small pocket of the clinic that's the man's bit.
The room that I was shown into to give my sample was a dimly lit room off a corridor with no windows, a wash basin, a hatch and a sofa and not much else really. It was very clinical. It was very, like, just do what you need to do and get over it.
The room can only be best described in my instance as a glorified toilet. It is actually a toilet for patients, but it kind of, there's a little section off the back, which is probably one of the most depressing things I've ever seen.
It was a little bit like what I would expect a man cave to be. There was a television there on a TV unit and a DVD player. There was a black leather chair and a footstool. There was a basin. There was a toilet, and next to the toilet there was a bidet.
Possibly the most awful room in the world. It was a small room with a couple of chairs, and actually we had a consultation process in the same room to sign the consent form for the egg collection earlier, which was bizarre.
I open the door and I go inside, and it's a really small room with a seat that has a plastic cover on it.
You walk past the toilet to get to this section where there is a little chair and a chest of drawers with a radio on top. The sole purpose of that radio is to try and, I suppose, one, for me, drown out any noise that might distract me from what I'm doing. And maybe some guys are noisier in others in doing what they're doing, so it's for patient and staff comfort. I don't know.
I went over to the TV unit, opened up the cabinet doors on there and found a couple of DVDs. One of them had a title something along the lines of The Revenge of the Busty Brunette.
And then on the wall, there's like a newspaper rack. And in the newspaper rack, there's a selection of pornography.
I remember there was some Gardener's World magazines. It was really bizarre when you're thinking about what you're about to do.
I didn't use any of their material that they had, but I did have a look. The pages were sticky.
What always got me was the fact it was off the corridor. You keep hearing people walking past, and to know that behind the small hatch was a team of doctors, and when you done your sample, they would be there to whisk it away and do what they needed to do with it.
I'm not going to bluff anyone or be naive enough to say I've never done it on my own before. That would be just stupid. But to have to do it in that setting, under pressure, with a timescale on the line, when you also know somebody else knows that you're doing it, is
yeah, not something that you can ever get used to. I always remember the hatch where you put your specimen through had a sign there saying, please make sure you're fully dressed before you put the sample through, which all I could think of was someone obviously has not been fully dressed. That sample thing, the poor embryologist has seen an eyeful. So I remember having a giggle and then realising that the pop-up magazines were underneath the Garden's Worth in another box, which I only found out afterwards.
The amount of funding for research for female fertility compared to male fertility is ridiculous. The difference is massive. So equally then, the preparation and information that women are given as opposed to men is completely different, which is, it just seems like it's really simple with men. So whilst there was loads of explanation for Devine, like, this is going to happen, you're going to be here, and we're going to take you in, and you're okay, and do you want some tea, do you want some water, with men it can feel like, right, here you go, go off and then, go off and, like, do your thing.
It seemed fairly odd. It was, a new experience, it was something totally different. I didn't think I knew what to expect. And it felt like everyone was just waiting for me to come back with a little pot and say, there you go, let's just continue. I wasn't given a huge amount of information. The things you have to do, so you have to fill out your information so that the right information goes with the right sample. Pretty much the extent of the instructions were, if you have any spillage, make sure you calculate how much spillage there is. I mean, how you do that when it doesn't go in the receptacle you're trying to get it in is beyond me, but that was one of the weird little things that I could never quite get my head around. But yeah, other than that, it was kind of like, well, you go into this room, you know what you're doing, just go and do it.
I was prepared for performing the easy bit to be stressful, but on the day itself, when you're given very, very strict guidelines as to what you should do and what you shouldn't do, I did find that much, much harder to deal with, because in essence you have to masturbate into a pot, and doing that is very, very difficult, and you're also told do not touch the inside of the pot with anything, and you also have to capture as much of it as you can, and what you mustn't do is not get the first lop not in the pot. And whatever you do, if you do make a mess, don't try and scoop it up. So there's all sorts of stress involved after having been told this by a couple of nurses, and everybody just waiting around the corner for you to do what you've got to do, and then ask you if you tick all the boxes for the process. So the whole thing was pretty stressful. Never had to do anything like that, even remotely, previously to this. So then having to ring the bell to say, here you go, finished, over to you. Even that itself was stressful.
Not easy at all. I will be open and honest about this. I don't think I've even spoke to Rachel about this, to be honest. I thought I'd just be able to do it from the wank bank, if you like. But turns out that the pressure situation was too much. And then, fortunately, there was decent Wi-Fi in the hospital, and I did have my phone on me, so I did have to resort to using some sites. But that was, I don't know, that was certainly better than trying to peruse the sticky magazines that were in the drawer. And as I said, at the end of the day, you've got one shot to do what you need to do. I'm not embarrassed about how we got to there. It doesn't bother me. So if I've got any advice to give anyone else, if you're going into that situation, try and put everything else out of your mind, obviously. But take whatever you need to take with you to do what you've got to do.
Part of my thought process is, don't mess this up. This has got to be really good.
I think I was more nervous that it would work, and my side of what I could offer would be good. The last thing I ever wanted was to see Sophie go through all that she did for, you know, my sample to not be good enough, or it not to be, work in a certain way because of that. Because when it came down to it, what I was offering seemed so small in terms of the physical sort of toil, the emotional toil. It was just go in the room, do what you need to do, and go.
It's a lot of pressure. You're building up, I suppose, this one moment. No pun intended. I suppose as a man, your wife has been through so much, the hormones, the egg collection, and for you, this is the one bit that you can do. And you put a lot of pressure on yourself, which then makes it worse and harder, and it's just a really unnatural, sterile process. I wouldn't show anyone.
Initially, it did take a bit of accepting that we would need donor sperm. It's not something we thought we could use, something that I had rather. So it was still sort of digesting the fact that there was nothing but myself that we could use. So initially very, very sort of thought-provoking and try and work out what way we go. But within a few months, the acceptance that actually this is a stranger helping us, a stranger giving us what we want, our dream, it became accepted pretty quickly. I do think of it as a sort of priceless gift from someone rather than the use of donor. It was tough because we thought we'd have more options to go through. So I think we both had these visions of being able to tailor someone that was a replica of myself. We wanted in our heads to find someone that was my height, my hair colour, build, job, to be as similar in appearance as we could get. The reality, the clinic were pretty good from the start of telling us, is that actually you may need to come back several months running to find a donor that is what you're after. There's just not the number of donors there to be able to be as picky as you would probably want to be to match your exact profile. At the time support was offered, I probably, like most men, didn't want any help, didn't want it, couldn't accept any help. The counsellor at the clinic was there at any time and you could book a session, but I think the only thing that could be slightly different was it was a couple sessions. I think maybe a bit of one-to-one time would have made things a bit easier for me. The whole process has changed me quite dramatically. It showed me I can be stronger than I thought I was. It showed me it's actually okay to talk about things. It's very private before it. So it's such an invasive process that you just have to accept things. So it's changed quite a lot of mannerism, what's important to you. You prioritise things completely different. So I can't think of one aspect of my life that's the same now as it was before the diagnosis.
At some level, it got me in touch with how absurd life and nature is. Nature and making life is. And here we are with IVF. My part is over really fast. And Davina's part is so much more involved, that involved committing things. She gives of herself fully, women give of themselves fully, completely to this whole experience, and sometimes it can feel physically that men, we're not as massively involved in the whole thing, even though emotionally we most definitely are.
So I hope you've enjoyed this slightly unusual episode of our Talk Fertility show. Do follow us on our Instas. I'm at FertilityPoddy. Kate is your_fertility_journey. And of course, you can email us talkfertility@gmail.com. And Kate will be answering more of your questions next week.